Kent Police are recruiting. This is not your standard job.
Unit 2 required to attempt crime in progress.
This is not your average 9 to 5.
Unit 2 on scene. Vehicle check, please.
Stand by control.
We don't subscribe to the daily grind.
Mail making off. Assistance required.
Stop, please!
This is the job that counts.
You're under arrest.
Suspect in custody.
A profession with real career opportunities. Become a Kent Police officer and join an outstanding force. Apply now at kent.police.uk.
Pleased to be joined today by Alison Hernandez, who's the Police and Crime Commissioner for Devon and Cornwall. We're literally going from coast to coast, from the southeast coast over all the way to the southwest. Alison, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, lovely to be here, Matthew. Lovely to be here.
You were just...
And don't forget the Isles of Scilly.
Of course.
I have to say it all the time. The actual force name is Devon and Cornwall, but as I represent the people, it's Devon, Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly.
Very good. Very good. And you're just telling me we've got exactly the same weather as well. So some things might be different.
Yeah.
Some things are the same. Exactly. Yeah. Well, so we're going to just crack on with some of the first questions. What we're interested to hear about is your story, basically. So I'd like to start by asking, you know, what motivated you to stand for Police and Crime Commissioner?
Oh, as with most things, it's a number of things as opposed to one moment in time or one incident that's happened. And I suppose I've spent most of my career working alongside police officers, either tackling crime and tackling poverty, interestingly enough, because I've had many roles in the past which are around running partnerships. And I've worked both at local government level, regional government level, and it's always been alongside the police. And interestingly, I've also then spent time training them in project management and leadership before I was a PCC. And so I know them, and I thought, well, you know, if anyone's going to stand for it, why not me? And that's the message I give to everybody about elected office. Why not, rather than why? Because anyone can be an elected person. And it's your choice about whether you choose to become part of a team within a party or you want to stand alone. But it's anyone can be one. That's the beauty of democracy. So I think I put myself forward mainly because of that experience of working with the cops. And I've met some inspirational police, let's be frank. There are some amazing superintendents that I used to work with and chief inspectors at that level in my past career. And we achieved great things. We introduced street wardens to Torquay in Heal, my home village that I grew up in, which was the most deprived area, I think it still might be, in the southwest. You know, we did some really great work together. So it was more about, I enjoyed working with them, so why not do a job where you can work with them more regularly?
Fantastic. And it was interesting to hear what you said there about, you know, why not. I actually saw a presentation very recently, you know, if not you, then who?
Who's,
yes, you know, it's, yes. It's quite an inspiring and sort of a motivational position, sort of give yourself a push forward. But you've done that. You've worked alongside policing. You've done things in local government and in partnerships. But have you always been political? I mean, did anyone particularly inspire you to get involved in the political side of things? And did anyone help you along that journey?
Yeah, that again has been a number of things, really. So I suppose, firstly, again, a bit like the PCC role, in the first round of PCC elections, November 2012, a lot of ex-military people or ex-police officers were going for that role because people didn't really know who should be in that role because it was so new. And there was a kind of expectation that you'd need to have that type of experience. And I thought, oh, well, you're just going to get men if you're going for those sorts of individuals. You'll end up getting men because it's men who've been in the most senior positions in the police and men who've been in the most senior positions in the military. So I really sort of wanted to push against that. So I wanted to show that, you know, someone with a completely different background who isn't a former anything. I am a jack of all trades, master of diversity, is my saying. So that's another reason what sort of motivated me to push myself forward for Police and Crime Commissioner. But the politics side, interestingly, it all started when Margaret Thatcher left Number 10. And I was quite inspired by Margaret Thatcher in the sense that I've only ever known women in my young life who were either teachers, cleaners, or carers. I didn't know any women lawyers from the family that I grew up in. I had no family friends who were accountants and things like that. Cleaners, carers, That's fundamentally the roles that, and teachers, the roles that I saw women do. And I didn't want to go into any of those jobs. And so Margaret Thatcher did inspire me that, you know, women could do something that was not those roles. And when she left number 10 Downing Street and she had that tear in her eye, my dad, who had never spoken to me about what political party he supported or voted for, literally swore at the telly saying, "Yeah, you effing bitch, get out." And I was like, wow, my dad really hates her. And he really hates the Conservatives. I didn't rebel, and that's why I joined them. But that was like the start of where I thought, well, I never knew my dad thought that like that. And I still don't know what he ever voted. He never, ever told me what he voted for, and neither did my mother. They were very secret about it, but they always made sure I went out to vote and took me to the polling booth at 18 with them to make sure that I used
probably
my vote.
Who didn't vote for in the 1980s.
But. Yeah, I could probably guess that.
But that's so very strong, though, isn't it? There are some of those views out there, aren't there? But particularly with politicians who can be seen quite divisive. They stir up emotion.
I think it's an emotional journey, and we've got this at the moment with the Brexit and Remain sort of issue, is that your own lives and personal experiences is what has brought you to that decision of what you think, whether you're a Leave or a Remainer. You cannot then berate anyone who thinks the opposite of you, because they've had life experiences and education that is different to you. So they might have different views about the world. And I think that's what I've really learned, is my dad was a really nice guy. He's really generous. He was a really kind, funny, swore a lot, which is sort of where I got it from. But, you know, it didn't make him a bad person because he didn't like a particular party or voted in a particular way. So for me, that's probably where it sort of started from. But I also had a local MP who did nothing. And I mean, got no funding into my hometown, which is still, again, the whole town is one of the most deprived in the southwest, at Torquay. My local MP did nothing. And he was in power for about 15 years. And I was so disappointed by him that it sort of motivated me as well to want to do something. So I did think about becoming a member of parliament. And that sort of drove me into where I then ended up going to become police and crime commissioner, and I wouldn't dream of becoming a member of parliament ever again.
Wow. Yeah, you've obviously been convinced by the role then, but I mean, you know, you've had three and a half years now. Obviously we're going to come on to some of the things that you've done during those 3 years, but what have you learned along the way? I mean, if you could go back in time and tell yourself something on your first day as a PCC, you know, that kind of thing, what would you tell yourself?
Wow. Well, I mean, there's probably quite a lot of personal stuff that I tell myself more than anything else. Interestingly, I was a victim of domestic abuse and stalking while I've been PCC. So if I was to give myself any advice, I'd say dump your boyfriend. That'd be the first one.
Okay.
I'd also say, particularly because we've got 13,500 miles of road, two mm-hmm. counties, 5 inhabited islands. You know, getting around that, right, means you really need to get some sleep, because you've got a lot of travel. There's a lot of driving. And I got a speeding ticket and I'm the national lead for road safety.
And you held your hands up held your hands up to that. And was it a parking ticket on the same day?
Yeah, and a parking ticket. It was Valentine's Day. Really, thanks. I got a lot of love that day.
Not from your friends at the Daily Mail.
No, but the point is that even me, who is on high alert because I'm the national lead for road safety, really cares about tackling deaths on our roads. Even I can get distracted. So you think, gosh, if even I can get distracted, that's how easy it is for everybody else who isn't in that position being held to account for their driving all the time. So that we know we need to do more to help drivers not be distracted while they're driving on the road. And I think there's something about how do we get that message across? That's a real challenge, but definitely get plenty of sleep, because there's been a few times when I've been driving back up from Cornwall at night where I've almost fallen asleep at the wheel. You know, so we've had to put in place sort of practical arrangements so that I don't drive there and back and do the meeting and everything. It just doesn't work. It's unsafe. And otherwise it means I've got to stay overnight in Cornwall and all of that sort of stuff. So get plenty of sleep would be a definite thing for me. And my third one, I've probably got three. Innocent until proven guilty has never been more paramount in my mind because after I had just got elected, I was under investigation for election expenses to do with the national battle bus scandal that the Conservatives had put around the country. Because So I'd been an agent for the local MP, Kevin Foster. He'd got elected, and there was this whole issue of should those expenses for that bus with all these volunteers that came and helped, should that have been on the local return for expenses or the national? And there was a big hoo-ha about it. But boy, you know, even me, after a year of being under investigation, and this is about important about swift justice, a year under investigation, I started to think, well, have I done something then? Because it's a year. You start to, and I would say it's so important that innocent until proven guilty. I was guilty in the media, you know, as soon as it was announced. So I think I probably understand how important it is to actually hold and protect that principle in life. It's really, really important. And and swift justice. That's why I've been driving, and I suspect you have as well in your area, making sure that things don't take so long to get to court.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, on all of those things, you know, it's really important that we maintain those fundamental principles, isn't it? That we do often see trial by media, the assumption that, that the person is guilty because they've been named in the media. But actually, there is a due process still to follow. But, you know, what I think one of the things I've admired about yourself, Alice, is the way that you are just so open and honest about these things, you know. When it comes, you mentioned the speeding ticket, and you know that happens to lots of people every day. But in positions of authority, it can become something of a story. Look, Nick Knowles, massive supporter of the police, gets caught with his mobile phone, I think. Wheel, held his hands up. You held your hands up, and again, even there, you're admitting to being a human being. You know, that you have to take precautions around sleep. It's a good reminder for everybody, actually, that, you know, don't drive if you're tired. Take plenty of rest and water and all that kind of stuff.
Well, and also, actually, I think, Matthew, with MPs and how politics is at the moment, everyone is literally thinking MPs are monsters, that they're not human beings with a life outside of Parliament. You know, and there's been a lot of abuse, particularly of members of Parliament, in light of everything that's been going on. And I think it's really important to remind people that we are human beings. And it's really important to do that, because then you're more approachable to the most vulnerable members of the society, that we are there to blimmin' help. You know, I mean, you know, vulnerable people aren't going to approach somebody who appears to be better than everybody else or perfect in some way. They want to know that you're fallible too, and that you will then be able to relate to them in some way with their problem. So I do think it's important, and we should hold on to that. I think it's dear that politicians are recognised as being human beings. I'm still learning how to be a politician, Matthew, so I'm still quite new at this, and I certainly can't do the party politics very well. In terms of this, you know, let's slag off the other side and make them. I just can't do that, because in this position particularly, I have to work cross-party all the time in the local areas, and we work very well together. And that's just how life goes on. You have to work together.
Absolutely.
To get things done.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've always said I'll work with anyone who wants to make my county safer. It's that simple at the end of the day, isn't it?
It is.
And that's how you can dismiss this notion that PCCs are party political beasts, that actually we are there day in, day out, just trying to make our county safer. And if, you know, if Labour, Liberal Democrats, Greens have got ideas around that, I meet them, I talk to them.
Yes.
Sounds like you're exactly the same.
I tell you the only ones I won't meet with, which isn't actually a political party, but Cannabis Club and those who want to legalise cannabis. I'm really so against it that I don't want to give them the time or hope that they think they're going to win something with me. They're probably the only people I haven't spent and used my time with.
Fair enough. Well, it'll be interesting to see what the outcome is of the consultation by NICE on the on cannabis and the effects on children. I think that could potentially revolutionise this debate once again as we've moved more towards legalisation. We'll see what happens. But you've mentioned you represent two counties and the Isles of Scilly. You've got 13,000, did you say, miles of road network?
13,500 and most of it rural. Most of it is not strategic road network.
Tell me a little bit more about Devon and Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly. What's the area that you represent?
Well, firstly, most people will know it's the most beautiful, as everyone will always say. Devon and Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly are some of the most beautiful places you can come and visit. The coastal walks, the beaches we've got, the amazing festivals we have, the weather is always better. Well, you know, not today. But there's something about, we're the largest force in England. So we've got 4,000 square miles. And we also have to investigate crimes 12 miles out to sea as well. So bearing in mind, we've got 730 miles of coastline surrounded by sea on three sides. You know, you've got 12 miles out to sea of potential investigations that our force has to run as well. So it doesn't matter who arrests them, border force or whatever. We still have to do the investigation. I think people don't recognise that. We also, because we're so beautiful and we love our tourists, but we are second only to London for the level of visitors that come here. So we are really trying to get, at the moment, recognised by government that we've got this sort of unique and exceptional policing challenge. When you've got, it's all, we like to call it sort of like an exploded city. Mm. So if it was in a city like in the Met, you know, everything is concentrated and dense, whereas ours is thrown around over 4,000 square miles. So you try policing that, it's a lot harder. And I think that's what we struggle with the most, is that sort of visibility in our sure. rural areas. But we've just had that Call the Cops programme on Channel 4, which some of the people who listen to this might have watched. And, you know, 84%, we believe 84% of the incidences that come into the police are non-crime related. And in terms of that, that means we have actually down here a high suicide rate. So our cops get called out to go and do the suicide negotiation. We've got a high level of missing people, either because we've got an older age group down here, the demographic. So we have dementia, people going missing from care homes. We have children going missing from care homes because we also have a large cohort of care homes as well for children. Yep,
ditto.
We've got these non-crime related activities that the police are involved in and have to help. So, and I think that's what we need government to help recognise, really, that it isn't just all, if we could just focus on crime, that would be lovely. But the reality is, day to day, the police are involved in all these other things that are about keeping people safe and protecting them. That isn't about the crime rate. And I think that's one of our biggest challenges down here. Because we've got exactly the same crime as anybody else has got. It's just the scale of it is different. And I suspect you're the same, Matthew. You know, some might be higher than others, but in our area, generally, we're lower than the national. Violent crime's been increasing, though. But we have exactly the same crime. So whether you've got loads of them or a few of them, you know, you still got to have the people who are able to deal with them and be able to investigate them. So we have exactly the same challenges, but the scale is different. So we're the sixth safest place in England and Wales. We used to be the third. So, you know, things have changed.
Sure.
And we need to get better at it.
Yeah, and I recognise a number of those challenges. I mean, obviously, Kent, you know, fantastic coastline as well. This is a bit of a marketing push for both of our forces, I believe, in terms of tourism.
Yeah.
But the, you know, fantastic coastline, lots of heritage, obviously being on the front line of many conquests with our cathedrals and our castles. We see that same sort of exploded city, as it were, places which will double in size in population during the course of the summer months, the diversity of it as well, being urban and rural and coastal, similar challenges in all but different in others. So you mentioned the trying to get government recognition for this. You've actually put in for some extra money for this, haven't you?
Yeah, so it's a route that ideally we wanted to influence the police funding formula. And we were trying to work out ways in which we could try and get recognition that we have these challenges to help with when the police funding formula, which is how they dish out the government money to all the forces, gets changed. So we thought we'd put in for this special grant because you have to have had exceptional circumstances to have been able to have claimed against this fund.
Mm.
And while, as it will be in your area, you know, policing the summer is business as usual, well, actually, it shouldn't be. It should be recognised that it's an exceptional thing that we do in the summer months, because it means, you know, people can't take annual leave. Police officers can't spend time with their families as much as they should. And that's important for their own welfare.
Yeah.
It means that all the training and everything gets pushed to the winter. And then people still want annual leave. Then they've got training. So really, the winter is a real challenge for us, because our community just gets a disservice, I think, because of the challenges with the summer. So, yeah, it's part of to try and get that recognition. And you can claim retrospectively for the funding through this special grant. So we've put in 3 years worth of what we think we've invested in to tackle the summer problem over the last 3 years, £17.9 million of funding. Now, I know that's a large number, and the funding pot itself is only £73 million. So I probably, you know, I know we're not going to get 17.9, but I just wanted it to put a marker down that, you know, these are the sorts of costs that we're talking about that we want to be recognised is a challenge for us. And if they give us any money whatsoever, to me, that would be they've recognised that we've got an issue. And I think that's the bit that I'm trying to get to.
In the meantime, you're trying to do different and innovative things in order to get that visibility, aren't you? You sent me something on WhatsApp about some of the schemes that you've been doing. What's this tri-service scheme?
We're really excited by it. We went up to Westminster, actually, to do like a pop-up police shop in Portcullis House, because we wanted MPs to have it, like, drop by and meet the tri-service individuals and the people who are managing that scheme, so they could see the sort of power of it. It's basically, we've worked with police, fire and ambulance, so I've all worked together, and in the embodied in one person, and we've got 10 of them now, but the embodied in them is they are a trained firefighter, so they're able to go and fight fires. They are a paramedic co-responder, so they can go and help people in serious incidences, like even heart attacks and all those sorts of things that the ambulance can't get to quickly. They can go and do that. And they're also got community safety accreditation powers from the chief constable. So they're not quite a full PCSO, but they can do policing. And they have, it's what's really interesting is that each community that they end up going into, which is our most rural in Cornwall, they tend to lean more into one element of the emergency service. So where there's a lack of fire cover, they might do a lot of fire shouts. Where there's a lack of policing, they might do a bit more on the policing side in that community. Where there's a lack of the ambulance being able to get there, they might do more paramedic side. So it's actually a brilliant way of leaning the right skill into your community as it's needed. We're really excited about them, and we've got some amazing individuals recruited through that process. I mean, some of them are international award-winning athletes, Matthew. I mean, wow. I was in awe when I met them, absolutely in awe, really incredible individuals. So I'd love to expand that. I'd love to have 100 least of them. But we're, you know, we've got 10. We're still evaluating it, but the first three were a real success.
Sure. I mean, they must have been able to do some tremendous things. Have you got any examples of some of the cases they've been involved in?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the main things that they do, they'll go and visit somebody who's been identified as particularly vulnerable to a fire, for example, because they've got dementia, and they might go and visit them in their home, and they'll make sure the fire alarms get fitted. While they're there, they might put a handrail up because they notice that the individual needs that help too. They pretty much could sort of do anything to help keep people safe. And they can pull in other resources if they want to. They've often sometimes been the first to a road traffic collision where they're helping to give paramedic help on those sides. And I'm actually going to speak later this week at a national conference on road collisions to talk about this particular role and what they've been doing in it about road traffic collisions and how quickly we can respond, because 60% of people die on rural roads rather than the big strategic road network. And sometimes that's to do with an ambulance just not getting there in time, you know, on our rural roads. So we've got some real challenges with that. They've been doing all sorts of things. They can pretty much do anything you need them to do in a community, because they can pull in so many other resources. And visibility has been the key. So they've been going into schools, talking to young people, been doing all sorts of sort of courses around antisocial behaviour, how they're tackling that with a community. And they can then feed into the other emergency services as required and pull the police in if necessary, or run something themselves. They've been really quite incredible, really. They wear grey. They're grey individuals, okay, which is a bit dull. But yeah, they have a grey outfit. So they're not red fire, and they're not green ambulance, and they're not black police. So they are grey.
Okay. Did you have much fun designing the uniform? Was that you or?
Oh no, they'd already done that before I'd arrived, when they designed their uniform. But we've also just got them some specialist vehicles as well, which is quite interesting, because this is the sad thing. I can't wait till, well, I say I can't wait. ECSMP, I can never get it right. The Emergency Services Communications and Mobile Service that they're going to be getting, this three emergency services all using the same network and facilities. At the moment, they have a police laptop, a police radio. They have an ambulance paramedic access laptop and a radio. With ambulance. And with fire, they have a fire laptop and a pager. You know, I mean, it's just, Crikey. They've got three lots of equipment. That bit is not integrated yet.
No,
that bit we're struggling with. Yeah,
it's unwieldy and bulky.
It is. So they need a car just to carry around the technology.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But it does show. Goes to show, doesn't it? We even had the conversations about blue light training for the vehicles. You know, if you're going to ride on blue light, how are we going to do that? Do you have to be trained by fire separately from police? And we've managed to work out that we'll just do one blue light training for driving for them. But we've all, you know, all of that, just sorting that out was a headache. You know, how do we get that accredited or accepted by each organisation? So it's been a bit clunky, but I think that's the test bed for it, really, is to try and find out what these problems are that are stopping us working better together.
That sounds great. And one of your other schemes you told me about is there's won awards as well, the Pathfinder scheme.
Yes. So, I mean, you probably are the same as me, as you like to tell the judiciary that your job is to make sure nobody goes before the courts. Not because you don't think people should be brought to justice, but because there are sometimes a lot better ways to actually deal with these individuals that come before us. Obviously, we want horrible, hardened criminals locked up and put away. But the people that you come across because of their circumstances that actually just need some help and support to sort their lives out, I've got evidence that works. So this Pathfinder scheme, it's like having probation at the front end of the system rather than what they are at the moment, which is after you've been in prison and you come out the other end. This is about almost having probation at the front end. So if you come before us at the moment and you're likely to get a caution, so it's a deferred caution scheme at the moment.
Okay.
If you're likely to get a caution for your offence, so that's likely to be public order offences. It might even be any sort of less violent offence, basically. We will work with them and give them a contract for 4 months. We have these amazing individuals who have all different backgrounds. Some are ex-police officers, some are ex-probation officers who are working with these individuals for 4 months. We help them get into mental health treatment if they need it, drug and alcohol treatment if they need it, helping them find a job, doing all sorts of things around that they need to be doing to get their lives back on track. And if they fulfill that 4 months correctly, they don't get the caution at the end. And we've had some amazing successes with that. I mean, just there was a woman who had been arrested for a public order offence. And it was all because she was getting hit by some adult children that her partner, they were her partner's children. They were adults and they had autism and they got violent in particular. And they used to hit her a lot, but she spilled out into the street one day because she'd been drinking. She just didn't want to put up with it anymore. And the neighbours all told her to shut up and go back inside. And she just wouldn't. And so the police were called and then she was arrested for a public order offence. Now, she then, when she got in front of our Pathfinder scheme, basically she left the partner and he was in her house. So she sofa surfed for a couple of months with her adult children until she could get him out of the house. She got a job in a care home working with troubled children, which she just wouldn't have been able to have got if she'd got her caution for a public order offence. And it was a first offence for her before the cops as well. So, you know, she's now said to me when I spoke to her, I said, how useful was the scheme? What did you find? She said, oh, Alison, I did it all myself. All you've done is give me the opportunity to do that.
Brilliant.
And I thought that really sums it up, because isn't that what we're supposed to be doing, is helping people turn their own lives around?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, as you quite rightly say, you know, the power of not having that offence on your record opens up so many more opportunities. But, you know, that sounds tremendous. So what does the future...
You'll know, don't you? We do want to lock up horrible, hardened, violent criminals. That's fundamentally what we want to do. I don't want to put ordinary people through poor circumstances who've made a mistake into prison or into the court system. I don't think it helps anyone. And I think that's an example of an offence that was, you know, there really wasn't really any victims but herself. Yeah. You know, that's a really good example of it, I think.
Great. So what does the future hold for you? Two questions in this one. Operation Uplift, the extra 20,000 officers, and then what the issues you'll be working on over the next few months besides that?
Yeah, so do you know, I'm actually quite sad, Matthew, about Operation Uplift. I tell you why, because there's all this national publicity about it. There was no national publicity about the fact that we were doing our local uplift, was there?
True.
You know, all the work and effort that we've been putting into as police and crime commissioners to prioritise police recruitment over anything else and get our officer numbers up. absolutely lost in that message. True. And just because the Prime Minister's decided to do it, it's a big hoo-ha. While I welcome it, and I'm absolutely delighted that
change of
that
Prime
Boris,
Minister. But, yeah.
Yes.
It's, I mean, you know, that was the frustrating thing about some of that. Obviously, Kent, biggest recruiting police force in the UK last year.
Yes.
291, got some of our officers in for this year in a bit early, but when the government was talking about 2,000 extra police officers, that wasn't due to them, that was due to us.
I know, you know, credit where credit's due, and I suppose it doesn't matter at the end of the day. You know, we're going to have a better, stronger police service as a result, but fundamentally we've got an election next year. You know, we're trying to let the public know our added value, and it sort of gets lost in the message sometimes. So we just got to keep pushing it out there. I know I'm well gel of what you've been doing in Kent. We haven't been able to do as much as you. I mean, we're recruiting around 675 police officers in my term of office before the uplift, you know, but the additional ones was going to be 176. So for me, there's just something about, you know, how do we get that message out? Because the future does matter about our community feeling safe, and they need to know we're on their side and that we're fighting for that. I mean, I think the public, because we were conservatives as well, sort of said, well, you've overseen austerity, you know, you supported it. Well, I'm not an MP. No, I didn't support it. I didn't vote for it. And actually, we all lobbied awfully a lot, didn't we, within the party with the former Prime Minister. And I think, you know, now we've got a new Prime Minister who I would say is a people's Prime Minister. He's like we are. He's acting like a directly elected mayor, and we are directly elected like a mayor.
But you're absolutely right. And, you know, Operation Uplift being announced last week with the extra 6,000, the first 6,000. A lot of my responses on Twitter that's, you know, you're getting 147, but you've cut 600. It's like, has everyone forgotten the 450 you've already done?
Yeah,
You know, because there hasn't been that national support behind the work that PCCs have done on recruitment in order to help with that narrative. You know, by March next year, by March 21, I'll have turned it round entirely on its head, police recruitment. Yeah. We lost 600, we'll have 600 back.
But you know as well as I do, those 600 won't be doing exactly what the 600 you were lost before.
No, that's also true,
Everything has changed in terms of policing priorities and how we're policing our communities. I mean, everyone has assumed the police are there to protect the public. Yes, they are. But actually, the biggest thing they do, and it's the right thing to do, is that they're protecting the most exploited and abused in our community, and that is people with learning disabilities.
Sure.
You know, these are our people in our community who have never been so protected by the police than they are today, and we should be really proud of that. They're not just all about patrolling the street and making everybody feel good. They are there to make sure people are not exploited and abused, and I think that's the right thing to do. That visibility issue is why I've looked at that tri-service option in Cornwall, because people want visibility, but, you know, sometimes it doesn't need to be a police officer. It needs to be somebody in uniform that can access the right people. And I think that's what we've been trialling with the tri-service there. We've also got, by the way, bi-service in Devon, which have just landed now. We've got 7 of them, and they are 21-hour-a-week paid firefighters who are in more of our coastal and rural locations that get probably about one fire shout a week. And so they are now fully trained special police constables, and they will be wearing a police uniform while going about their 21-hour-a-week duties, because most of that time they could be doing crime prevention and reassurance activities because they're not going out to a fire shout. So we're really excited about that one. We're the first in the country to be able to do, it's almost like full-time employer-supported volunteering.
Yeah.
And that's what we'd like to do, a lot more of that employer-supported volunteering, because I think that will help transform visibility in some of our most coastal areas as well.
Brilliant. So in the next coming months, what's next on the agenda? You're getting your extra police officers in, you're doing your summer grants bid. What else is on the agenda for the next couple of months?
Well, we've got our budget setting process that we'll be going into. And I think the uplift of officers allows me to rethink actually what we've already been planning to spend in the following year, 2020 to 21. So I'm actually in the process of, can I rethink my own local budget? I've got to check whether or not the uplift is linked to what I've already got planned for 2020 to 21. But if it's not, I'm going to be rethinking that, because we need to look at our PCSOs again.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, we were the last force in the country, Matthew, to reduce our PCSOs, the last force, all under my while I was here. So it makes me look like the bad guy. But the reality is we had to prioritise police officer recruitment.
Sure.
And now I'd really like to go back and see if we can have a look through the budget process, what we could do. I'd love more of my blue light buy and try service, but I think we do really need to think about how we can support our PCSOs a bit more.
And I think that, you know, that shows the strength of how PCCs are thinking differently. I mean, we kept our PCSO numbers here in Kent around the same level. In fact, there'll be sort of about 30 more by the end of this year than when I was elected. But actually, I think what you've articulated is something that I've spoken about here and some other colleagues are now talking about, is those, that valued group of people that we don't hear enough about in the mainstream press, is the police staff roles, the PCSOs, the detention officers, the call handlers, the analysts, all those roles which were lost too. We're now starting to have a think a bit differently about how we can support policing through police staff roles.
Yeah, because the reality is, in fact, there are even some policing roles I would question should be police officers. We've got, you know, what you need stability in some of these areas of business in order to make sure that you can make a real change, and there's accountability for that change. And in a lot of instances, police officers will move on in 2 years. They'll do a 2 year stint somewhere and then they'll be looking for something, a specialism to go into or a promotion, and nobody sticks around. Whereas police staff are quite a stable population. I mean, our PCSOs are probably the longest serving frontline people in that we've got in the force. You know, they've been there sort of 10 years, some of our PCSOs. They know their communities inside and out. And if you've got a police officer in that role, the biggest thing I've learned is that they just keep changing every 2 years. So you won't get the stability necessarily in the same way that you would with police staff. And that's why they're so valuable. And I think we need to really think about how we are looking at police staff. And it doesn't it's not an election winner, is it? Hey, let's have some more police staff and not police officers. But it's an important element to understand why it's more added value to look at it from a police staff perspective than a police officer.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I have members of my family who are police staff, so I've always been biased. My brother's policing career started off as a PCSO. You know, mum and sister work in police staff roles, so, and my dad does now as well. Actually, he retired and then came back as police staff.
This is a real family affair.
Yeah, I'm the odd one out because I got elected into a policing style role rather than anything else. But you know, I know the work that they do, but also I get to see it when I do my force visits. It's about, you know, going to see all the different teams, not just police officers. As great and brilliant and difficult and dangerous things that they do, there are police staff there too who sometimes do get overlooked, as you quite rightly say.
Well particularly because they're on the front line. So we had the party chairman visit us a few weeks ago, and my first port of call when he wanted to meet some police officers was, actually, you're going to meet the front desk, you're going to meet the police inquiry officers who receive and meet all the public day in and day out. It's a thankless job most of the time, and so we took them there. The other front line is our 101 call handlers, isn't it? I mean, they are speaking with the public. They are part of the front line, and I don't think they get recognised in the same way. So we really do need to help the public understand the critical nature of some of these areas of business.
Brilliant. Alison, thanks very much for joining me on the podcast. We cover quite a lot of ground there, but I'll make sure that the links for Alison's website are available in the description of this podcast, so you can go away and find out more about her work in Devon, Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly. Alison, thank you very much.
Thank you, Matthew. Take care.